Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working at...
An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, obviously, it's not Chuck and Julie. It's a beautiful Wednesday. The weather has switched back and everything's getting nice outside. So Chuck and Julie are going to their kids' graduation ceremony this afternoon. So they asked me to fill in and we're going to talk about a few things. Hopefully, there'll be some people asking questions and we can talk about all kinds of law enforcement stuff. As you know, I'm Mark Poff. And let me give you the call-in number. We're going to talk a little bit about the Texas shooting here in a minute. So if you want to call in and say some things about that, feel free to do that. The number is 888-627-6008. Obviously, we're also on Zoom. And so if you put stuff on the message board, now Julie usually looks over there while Chuck's talking, and then she sees if there's any chats going on. If there is, you'll probably see me sneak a peek over to see if anybody puts anything out there. But I just want to say thanks to Chuck and Julie for letting me do this. I love doing it every once in a while. I'm a little bit, you know, I still have a lot of things going on, just like with Chuck and Julie. So occasionally I love to do this, but have a lot of stuff going on. So, and I love to give them the time off because I love their show. I try to get on and watch their show as much as I can. So I want to give them some time off. But one of the things that I wanted to talk about was about grand juries. And we're going to get to that. And John St. Augustine is going to join in after I explain a few things. And we're going to talk about our experiences. For those of you that don't know myself, Mark Poff and John St. Augustine, we're both prior law enforcement. We both were detectives. And John was actually the commander of investigations. And I worked for him doing computer crimes and other type of major cases. And we both retired almost 8 years ago, went into private business, if you want to call it that. And we've been working as consultants, mainly working for defense attorneys. And I have to tell you, for me, it really opened my eyes about how the judicial system works in the state of Colorado and some concerning things about what some law enforcement and district attorneys do on a routine basis. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But first, I know probably on everybody's mind right now is the school shooting down in Texas. And I have to tell you, you know, I was pretty upset to begin with, as everybody should be appalled whenever somebody does something that unbelievably over the top. And take so many lives, to take any life, but to do something like that with children is just inconceivable. And so, you know, I was all set to talk today about, you know, letting law enforcement and letting them do their job, let them do their investigation, and then moving forward. But then I saw this press conference that the governor, Abbott, was doing down in Texas. And then I saw Robert Francis O'Rourke interrupt this news conference to basically try to get some fame. You know, he's running for governor on the Democrat side in Texas. I mean, for him to disrupt a press conference talking about a school shooting and the sensitivity of that whole event and everybody's outrage that this happened, and trying to show some comfort and coming together as a community, and the governor coming down to express his concerns and try to help. And to have him interrupt that was just unbelievable. And I watched it two or three times. And I really think, I don't even like to call him by his nickname because I don't want to give him credit for that. You know, O'Rourke is an idiot. And sometimes idiots just feel the need to ensure that everybody knows they're an idiot. And for him to interrupt that and talk about what he did just to try to get fame and get some notoriety because he's running for governor, that's the whole problem with these kind of events, is that you have individuals that want to politicize these events before they really know exactly what happened and start saying all kinds of stuff. And the thing that I found, even in past events and going into this event yesterday, is they all have to act like they're more outraged than everybody else. I'm more outraged in this event ever before. We've got to show some backbone going against the lobbyists. Well, I don't think the lobbyists are the reason that we have gun laws the way we do. I think it's because of the citizenship of the United States and people understanding their rights to bear arms. And so they can't really attack that, because a lot of people who understand the right to bear arms are Democrats, and they don't want to go after their own party. So they talk about the lobbyists and the gun control, or not gun control, but the gun advocates, but they don't want to talk about individual gun owners. You know, when a lot of this stuff was going on last summer and a lot of these riots and stuff, guns were selling off the shelves faster than they could put them out there. And a lot of them were being purchased by Democrats. And so my point in all this, you know, you had the Buffalo shooting last week, then you have this shooting, you know, yesterday. Who controls Congress? It's not the Republicans. It's the Democrats. They control Congress. How come there's no bills going forward to move their agenda to try to stop these shootings? And I wonder if this time as well, you were going to hear this outrage. They're going to blame it on the Democrats, that we know they're going to stop the legislation. You know, we can't do anything. But yet they don't try to do anything. You control Congress. Why don't you stop with trying to shut down all of our energy sectors and making us, you know, no longer energy independent? And why don't you try to fight your gun control laws and see how that works? But I don't think they're going to do much. And we'll see. We'll see what happens. But I wanted to talk about that. And another thing is, you know, I was on a school board for 12 years when a lot of like the Sandy Hook and some other type shootings happened. And one of the things that we did at the Lewis Palmer School District down here in Monument, Colorado, is we took a little bit more of a proactive role in trying to deal with these kind of things from the standpoint of, you know, and I was on the board, I thought that the solution or one of the things to help was not to have these gun-free zones. I think that's kind of bogus. You know, you put up a sign and it says gun-free zone, no guns. All you're really saying is no legal owner can have a gun on this premise. And we have it with all of our schools that you can't bring firearms onto the school. And I get that. But what that is really signaling to individuals with mental illness is that it's a soft target. And you've heard this term, you know, soft targets. And that's where they're going to go. It's like a burglar when they're driving down a street, if they start seeing a bunch of signs that says, you know, residents protected by ADT, or is that right? You know, security system, then they'll go to the next house. So the goal here is not to have a gun-free zone in our schools, but to have guns in the right hands in our school zones. So what we did at Lewis Palmer, which a lot of other school districts did as well, is we hired armed personnel. And we brought them into our schools. We didn't advertise this. We didn't have them walking around with guns exposed. They actually had their weapons concealed. And they were just security monitors that were working at our different schools. And they were armed in case something happened. And they had radios to communicate and stuff. So I think in this situation, and I saw some of the briefing this morning, is that there was some officers around and got there relatively quick, that I think really changed his what he was doing. There was some talk that he dropped a bag of ammo out in the parking lot before he even went into the school. They trapped him in one classroom and held him there until they could go in and take care of it. So I'm, especially being previous law enforcement, I'm interested to see how this all, I don't want to say plays out, but how the investigation works. And I think we have some heroes in law enforcement that actually made the situation not as bad as it could have been. But so that's all I kind of really want to say on the whole school shooting. But moving forward, one of the things that I wanted to talk about today was about grand juries. And, you know, I used to work for law enforcement as a detective, never actually interfaced with a grand jury. But if you actually read the Constitution, it basically says in the Fifth Amendment that everybody's entitled to a grand jury. Well, that's actually not completely true. That's the way it is for federal cases. So if you're indicted, if you want to call it that, on a federal level, they have to go in front of a grand jury because of the Constitution. And the grand jury basically does what's called a true bill or an indictment and says, yes, we feel, listening to what you've told us, that there is enough to prosecute, you know, to indict this person. There's probable cause to pursue this case further. And there's actually a lot of advantages to a grand jury over a normal investigation, if you want to call it that. What I'm used to doing back when I was a detective is I would be given a case. So I'd get a report or something from a patrol officer, or maybe we'd have a major case that we'd go out on a homicide or something. And then we'd start doing our investigation. We would determine who our suspect is. We would establish probable cause. And then we'd write an arrest warrant or a PC affidavit, and we'd go arrest our suspect. And this is typically after a thorough investigation. We would write this arrest warrant. We would take it over to the judge directly. The judge would read through our affidavit and then say, yes, I believe based on your affidavit, there is probable cause to arrest this individual for the crime that you've stated in your affidavit. Well, then you have these really cool things called grand juries. And a lot of times at a state level, like I said, from a federal level, you have to use grand juries. On a state level, you do not. You can actually have detectives or law enforcement officers writing these affidavits to arrest people, and then they're reviewed by judges. Occasionally, a district attorney would determine that maybe we just can't, we haven't established enough probable cause. So there's some question as to if there is enough to arrest this individual. Well, what better scenario than running that evidence in front of a grand jury, which is normally made up between 12 and 23 individuals of the community, and they usually serve for about a year. Just convene the grand jury, run the evidence through, have the detective testify, lay out the evidence to this grand jury, and then see what you think. So it's kind of like a precursor to laying it out to a regular jury. And then if they say, look, there's enough probable cause, then you get what's called a true bill. And then the DA can file an indictment, and then you can go arrest that individual. Sounds like a great idea that you're actually kind of being judged by your peers even before you're arrested, you know, to establish probable cause. Unfortunately, a grand jury can be very manipulated. And one of the things I've always said, whenever you have a situation or a law or something that requires someone to do the right thing, it can always be perverted by an individual that has other ideas of what they want to do other than enforcing the law. And that's the key when it comes to a district attorney, is they're to do the right thing. They're to seek the truth and then pursue wherever the truth leads them. But when you get a district attorney or a detective or whomever who's basically saying, I think that person's guilty and I'm going to do everything I can to convict that person, that's really not how the system's supposed to work. So when you hear this phrase that you can indict a ham sandwich in a grand jury, that is very true. And from the standpoint of, if you understand how grand juries work. Now, in a regular jury, the district attorney, and then you have your defense attorney, then you have 12 people on your jury. You couldn't have a district attorney buddying up with the jury. But on a grand jury, they actually sit on a grand jury for up to a year, and the district attorney actually can talk with them, buddy up with them, have side conversations with them, so they can build this rapport with the grand jury members, and that can cause problems. Now, a grand jury is a great idea if you want to actually use it for an investigative tool. You can compel people to come in and testify in a grand jury. You can make them raise their right hand, and the actual grand jury members can ask them questions. And sometimes, you know, putting somebody on a stand and having them testify, that can kind of shake the truth loose a little bit. And so sometimes you can get more information in a grand jury. But on the other side of that, a grand jury is run by the district attorney. So they can bring individuals that they want to come in. And then if they know that there's another witness who might be exculpatory or might make statements that might show the innocence of the individual that they've targeted, he's not compelled to bring that person in. There's no reason or nothing compelling a district attorney to bring in anything that shows the innocence. So they get the opportunity to bring in everybody they want that shows the evidence that might imply that this person's guilty. So you can see how this can be manipulated by a corrupt district attorney, which we definitely had in a guy named Mark Hurlburt. And I would definitely tell you there's a DA, used to be a DA named Dan May that was very corrupt. And these individuals, especially Mark Hurlburt, is one that I had some interactions with or got to see exactly what he did. They basically manipulated a grand jury to target a political rival. And they lied. They provided false information, straight up false information to a grand jury. And they were caught. Then when they were called out on this, they basically said, yeah, what are you going to do? You know, I have immunity. And ultimately in this case, the federal judge agreed with them that, excuse me, I do not have COVID. And throughout the case, and we're all familiar with the John St. Augustine case, they actually, to kind of go through the history of this, and I think I've told most people that that case was thrown out recently by a federal judge. If you go through the history, John talked about the Tom Clements murder to a news reporter up in Denver. And within days, all of a sudden, this grand jury was convened to go after Terry Makeda. And they brought up John St. Augustine and they compelled him to testify and said that he was just a witness. But then it ultimately turned out that he was a target, which there's some issues with that. And Mark Hurlburt actually asked John's attorney to say, look, we want John to come in and testify against Sheriff Makeda that he ordered him to arrest this individual, knowing that there was not probable cause to arrest this person. John said it never happened, so he couldn't testify to it. The next thing he knows, he's indicted for kidnapping of an individual he's never met. There is no evidence other than the false evidence that was provided by a CBI agent, Ralph Gagliardi, who provided false information to the grand jury. What he said was there was this meeting, this supposed meeting, well, there was a meeting where they decided that there was enough to arrest this individual for domestic violence. Well, he said that John was in the meeting and they had evidence to show that based on key card information. Turns out that's 180 degrees wrong. The key card information actually showed that John key carded out of the parking structure 20 minutes before this interview ever took place. So he wasn't in the meeting where they decided to arrest this woman. And by the way, there was a district attorney who's now a judge, Shannon Gerhardt, who was in the meeting, who did authorize the arrest. And so why wasn't she charged with kidnapping? Some of John's supervisors were actually in this meeting who were in on the decision. None of them were charged. So the only person who was charged with kidnapping was the one individual who wasn't in the meeting who refused to lie to the grand jury for Mark Hurlburt. So that's why they targeted him. And there was some depositions in this case. And Ralph Gagliardi basically admitted that the information he provided was not accurate and true. And when they talked with Mark Hurlburt, he said, there's no reason for me to provide any type of information to show that John had nothing to do with this. And he openly admitted that he targeted John St. Augustine to get to Terry Makeda. So, and as it turns out, everybody knows, and I know from reviewing the case, there was no crime against Terry Makeda, did not commit a crime. This was all trumped up by Dan May and his goons to go after Terry Makeda because he wanted to get revenge. That's my opinion. So what happened was, is John St. Augustine was indicted, and he provided through his attorney, Iris Etan, she provided all this information to show that he had nothing to do with this. He wasn't even there. They provided the key card information and said, wait a minute, you guys you know, you provided this information to the grand jury. It was not good information. It was false information. Here's the actual key card data that shows that John wasn't even there. And they made some excuses that he could have ghosted in and followed other people around the building without using his key card, which is absurd. He would have had no place to park because he has to key card into the parking structure. The whole concept was ridiculous. And for 18 months, Mark Hurlburt, being the corrupt DA that he is, allowed this indictment to stand. So John couldn't work for 18 months, ruined his life. He had to pay all this money to get an attorney to fight this. And then 3 weeks before the trial starts, Mark Hurlburt goes into a hearing and says, I'd just like to do a motion to dismiss. And he realized that the damage had been done. He ruined a life, but Mark Hurlburt didn't care because that's not his goal. His goal was to ruin people's lives, and he was somewhat successful. So what happened was, is you had this corrupt district attorney who manipulated a grand jury, a CBI agent provided false information to the grand jury. And here's the ultimate point in all of this. There's no repercussion. A federal judge says, you know what? They have immunity. They can lie to a grand jury. You can provide false information to a grand jury. And you can have a DA indict someone for 18 months, ruin their life, knowing that it's not truthful and that he had nothing to do with any of this. There literally was no crime committed. And no one else was arrested or convicted of this. They knew it was all trumped up, but they got away with it because they have immunity. And so that's the issue that I have with grand juries. And it's just been driving me crazy over this time because I've been sitting on the sideline watching John St. Augustine, who is a person who has so much integrity. And I've seen him over the years. We've worked on so many investigations together, always trying to get to the truth and do what's right for our community. To see him manipulated by a corrupt district attorney, Mark Hurlburt again, to use his name, so everybody knows. And oh, by the way, he's the same DA that was actually on the Barry Murphy case that just here recently they dropped the charges against him. He knew there was exculpatory evidence in that case, which apparently was not released to the defense until later on. And then again, same type of MO. This is the same guy who lost the case to Kobe Bryant. He loses the case against Terry Makita. He goes after John St. Augustine and trumps up charges that never happened against him to go after Terry Makita. And then now, you know, here he is on another case in Buena Vista where apparently there was exculpatory evidence that he knew he didn't have a case. And so he ends up having to drop the charges later after costing this guy thousands of dollars in legal fees and stuff. So that appears to be his MO. So that's kind of the talk on the whole grand jury stuff. But moving forward, like I told you, John St. Augustine and I both worked for the El Paso County Sheriff's Office. I was a detective. He was a commander, worked on numerous death investigations, homicides, major cases. And then, you know, we decided about 8 years ago, about 7.5 years ago, that we wanted to, I don't want to say switch over because I don't think that's the right term, but we thought it would be interesting to actually start working for the defense and work as consultants. We still work for prosecution as well. I've worked for DA's offices that have retained me, and I'm more than happy to work for them as an expert. So we kind of got our eyes open, you know, when we switched over. So I'm going to, whenever you can, Thomas, you can bring in John St. Augustine. If you want, John, you can turn on your audio and your video. And I kind of want to talk about some of these eye-opening events that we've had since we started going into business together and working on some of these cases. And one of the things I'll say is one of the things I've definitely learned, you could definitely charge any elected official with official misconduct if you can get a DA to back you on it. Because, you know, the whole concept of official misconduct is that you do anything to benefit yourself. So you can manipulate about anything you want to make that case. But some of the things, and we're going to talk about this a little bit. I was kind of surprised, John, when we first started doing this, how individuals that I thought were my friends over at the district attorney's office, some of them weren't my friends anymore because I was, you know, they were finding that I was working for defensive, for the defense team.
Sorry, Mark, I didn't quite copy that what you just asked.
Well, what I was saying was, is when we transitioned from going from law enforcement officers, from detectives, right, and started working for mainly defense teams. I mean, we're more than happy to work for prosecutions. You worked for the Lacey Peterson case out in California, so they retained you to help for the prosecution. I've done it here with some DA's offices here in Colorado. But for the most part, it's defense teams, you know, defense attorneys that hire us to work on cases. And we found a lot of interesting cases. But one of the things is that some district attorneys that I thought were my friends all of a sudden weren't quite so friendly with me.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's unfortunate because, you know, if you really look at what the role of the prosecutor is to seek justice, right? And
right.
The role of an investigator is to do what? Is to gather facts. And, you know, whether you're working in a law enforcement entity, working for a law enforcement entity, or you're working as an investigator for the defense, at the end of the day, it's all about the facts, right? I mean, you know, if a guy committed a crime or a gal committed a crime, what I can tell you is that, you know, there's evidence to support that. And the reality is that, you know, in our roles as either a defense expert or a defense investigator, is to see whether or not the government is doing what they're supposed to be doing. And so, you know, this thought of, you know, and as you mentioned, I mean, there are some prosecutors that I've known over the better part of almost two decades that, just like you said, because now you're working for the defense, kind of categorize you as somebody who's now not worthy of you know, your friendship. And it's unfortunate that, you know, it's gotten to that. But, you know, at the end of the day, what it should be about is, you know, was this case properly investigated? And do they have the right person? And if they have the right person, guess what? You're going to have evidence to support it. I mean, you know, in our, what, you know, almost two decade time of working in law enforcement, I can tell you with 1,000% certainty that we never arrested somebody without evidence, right? I mean, if there was any question, and Mark, you know, we've visited this a number of times, you know, when we were both working in the profession, where, you know, we were like, you know what, we should not make an arrest, that we don't have enough to make an arrest, and that we should pump the brakes, right? Let's reevaluate. Let's do more investigating. Let's do more fact gathering. And that, you know, maybe this individual is not the individual who's responsible for this particular crime. You know, to give you an example of one, I remember a case, there was a murder case. It was in Security Widefield and it was back in the early 2000s. And I remember that there was an individual that was arrested based on some gunshot residue that was found on him. And what happened was, it's a really weird dynamic. Guy answers the door, he's murdered. Okay. What happens after he's murdered is that another group of people who had nothing to do with the first group of people, within seconds of this murder happening, actually walked in to rip him of his drugs. Well, this second group that walked in obviously weren't involved in the murder, but because they had this gunshot residue on them, the assumption was that, hey, they're the ones that were in there after. They must have been the guys. And you know, when you look at it from a fairly logical standpoint, you go, well, man, how, you know, what are the odds of that happening? Well, guess what? The odds of it happening happened. And so, you know, we have to be very careful, you know. And you know, I heard you just for a brief moment talk about the other side. You know, I think one thing that people need to understand is that this is not a one side or the other side. The way you need to look at these cases, any criminal case for that matter, is that it's all about the facts. Is there evidence to support the criminal allegation? Does it meet the statutes, right? Does it meet the elements of the statute? And if there's evidence to support that, you or I will say what we have to say as far as, right, these are the facts of the case. You can't buy our testimony. And, you know, that is where, you know, it's unfortunate that it's become more of an adversarial relationship with these prosecutors, because at the end of the day, you know, we've how many murder cases, how many attempted murder cases, how many sex assaults, how many sexual exploitation cases, armed robberies. I mean, go through the list of people crimes that we've done in our careers, working with these prosecutors who now, because we work on the other side, have really, you know, dismissed us as being, you know, as being friends, which is, you know, the most disheartening thing, because you've worked with these people for so long and they don't truly understand that, you know, the role of the prosecutor is truly just to seek justice. Yep. Right? You know, and what it's all about now is it's about wins and losses. This is not a basketball game. It's not, you know, game five of the Mavericks and the Golden State Warriors. It's about people's lives. And if you know that you have evidence to support that they're innocent, that there's exculpatory evidence, you have an obligation as a prosecutor to present that. You know, but what we've done is we've given these people immunity, and now they've ran amok. What has gone on now is, now because it's about wins and losses, it's not about the truth. And, you know, that was not the way our forefathers designed this system, right? Defense attorneys, you know, even if they know that their client is guilty, they have to zealously defend them. But a prosecutor does not mean that they have to win at any expense. They have to seek justice, which, if they know that somebody is innocent, they should ethically, right, dismiss the charges, right. But they don't do that. And we're seeing that, unfortunately. And I think that's part of why this dissension, I don't know if dissension is the right word, there's this animosity or this lack of respect that's being, you know, that has been given to us when we work on these defense cases, is because now it's become about wins and losses, and it should not ever be about that. You know, look, I'm the first one to tell you, if a guy is guilty of a crime, you know what? There's a system designed to tell us what they should serve for that crime. You know, if it's first degree murder and you're charged and you're found guilty of it, you're going to be in prison for the rest of your life. If it's second degree murder, you know, up to 48 years, and you can go down that path, right? No different than attempted murder, sexual exploitation, sexual assaults. That's up to a judge to decide the sentencing. It's up to a jury to decide whether or not they're innocent or guilty. And it's up to investigators to gather facts. It's up to experts to present the facts in an expert way. And it's up for the prosecutor to seek justice and the defense attorney to zealously defend their client. Right. But we're not doing that.
And I've explained, you know, the DA is to seek the truth and to get justice. A defense attorney is to seek the best outcome for their client. Mm-hmm. So those are different roles. And, you know, I've definitely learned from, you know, now that we've done this for over 7 years, you got to have every seat filled to have the system work right. And I've seen it work right. I worked on a case just a few years ago, and it was a homicide. And the client, you know, I was working for the defense team, and the client was being charged with murder. And the cell phone records, which is my area of expertise, did not show that his cell phone was where this homicide took place. And that was just one element of everything. One of the individuals that was in the car that testified that they witnessed the murder said the guy wasn't there either. So based on the fact that someone who was providing them information and the fact that the cell phone records corroborated the fact that he wasn't there, they dropped the charges on this individual. That's how the system's supposed to work.
Right. And on the flip side, Mark, not to interrupt you, but, you know, I was recently involved in a case involving a young Air Force Academy cadet, top of his class. He ends up being accused of sexual exploitation of a child, which, you know, for those of you that are listening, what that means is that this individual possessed, some sexually exploitative material, meaning underage
child pornography,
kids, right? Child pornography.
Child pornography.
Yeah. So, you know, when you look at this, you're asking yourself, okay, if you're going to charge this guy with sexual exploitation of a child, possession of child pornography, shouldn't you at least have child pornography? There wasn't a single
element of the crime.
Yeah, it's an element of the crime. There wasn't a single piece of evidence that was found by the government that revealed that this kid had any child pornography.
Yet they kept charging him.
What's that?
They charged him, and then they ultimately went to trial with
that. And went to trial. It went to trial.
Spent thousands of dollars defending himself.
That's correct.
And what did the jury ultimately say?
And the jury in 6 minutes came back with a not guilty verdict, you know, and I testified in that case. And you know, I gave the analogy of imagine being charged with possessing a Schedule I narcotic. Like, you have some drug on you and they say, hey, I'm going to charge you with this, but yet that drug is never found. And I said, this is the same thing that happened with this child pornography case, is that they're saying that this guy possessed child pornography, but yet they could never present any evidence to support that. None, not a single piece of evidence. And, you know, he was found not guilty. But here's the problem that nobody realizes is that, you know, the damage is already done when the allegation is made.
Right. How's his career going to go?
His career is done. And in fact, he was not able to graduate with his graduating class from the Air Force Academy. So it's just another one of these examples where, you know, a person's life is destroyed based on no evidence. But because, you know, some law enforcement official had a rush to judgment, put together some bogus probable cause affidavit to get this arrest done, had a judge sign off on it. He was ultimately charged. He was ultimately arrested. He ultimately went to trial. But yet there wasn't a single piece of evidence. Right.
And the
district attorney knew there was no evidence.
And let it happen.
Let it happen.
One of the things that I've noticed in some of my cases is what I call the massive overcharging. And I read an affidavit, and I hate to keep, bring up the same type of case. I'd rather bring up a different kind of case. But they said on this guy's cell phone, they found substantial amounts of child pornography. So that's how they wrote the PC affidavit, substantial amount of child pornography. So they arrest this guy, and he fortunately has enough money to, you know, get an expert. And I actually go to the district attorney's office to see this substantial amount of child pornography. And when I get there, the DA tells me, well, there's 4 images. And I'm like, that's substantial is 4 images? And then I look at these images, none of them, they're all adult females. None of these are children. And I'm sitting there going, this is never going to fly in a court of law, you know, and yet they kept trying to establish this case. And then after some effort and stuff, you know, we got everything worked out. But that's the thing that just drives me crazy is your goal is to get to the truth, not to make this huge allegation against an individual. So they have to cut a deal. I mean, think about it. You know, those are some big dice that you're rolling. You know, we see on TV where individuals, I'm going to fight this. We'll go to trial. But when you have limited funds and your whole life is sitting in front of you that you may spend 20 years in prison if you lose this.
Right.
And then they offer you a deal of, well, we'll give you probation and you know, whatever. And it's like, I'll take it. But yet right. Your life, again, is ruined because you're a convicted felon.
I'm sorry to interrupt you on this, Mark. And it's just a thought that, you know, I know you and I have discussed this before, but the way you stop a lot of this is you have to hold these prosecutors accountable. And I know that I'm going to probably get, you know, some heat for this my opinion on this. Right. But the reality is they should not have immunity. Right. I mean, think about it. What profession out there, if you're a doctor, if you're a lawyer, if you're an engineer, if you're a dentist, if you're a construction worker, you name any profession, everybody's accountable for their actions. Why is it that a prosecutor can go out and arrest, have somebody arrested, right? Continue on and allow the process to work its way through and know darn well that they have evidence to support their innocence and you cannot do anything to them? Once those charges are filed, you cannot do anything. You cannot go and sue them, even though you know darn well you're innocent of it. You can't do anything to them. They're immune. Right. They should not have immunity. There's the only person who's immune is the guy upstairs. There shouldn't be anybody else immune to anything that they do. You should be held accountable for your actions, no matter what the occupation is, to include prosecutors.
Yeah. And one of a case that I worked on just a couple of years ago. Is, you know, I was brought in to review this PC affidavit that law enforcement did on a drug dealer. I'm going to keep it generic, but it was a drug dealer. And they were trying to establish evidence against him. And so they had this I want to say a warrant for his arrest for some minor charge. So they went to a judge and said, hey, we want to ping his cell phone so we can go get him. He's a threat to the community and to himself, a danger to the community. So we want to go get him. We don't have any idea where he's at. So we want to ping his cell phone so we can go arrest this person. Well, the judge signs the warrant. Well, they ping his phone for over a week. They know exactly where he lives. He pings at his residence on where they know where he lives, but they don't go get him. They continue to ping his cell phone, find where he's going to a used store at place. And they said, aha, you know, that here's the places that he's going. And then they go there and check out and find a whole bunch of drugs. Right. Well, that they lied on the affidavit. The affidavit was not to apprehend this individual. They wanted to get more evidence against him. So they wanted to ping his phone, which is illegal. You can't do this. So they could find if he was doing something illegal. They do end up find a whole bunch of drugs and go arrest him based on this warrant. Well, I brought this to the attention of the attorney, and we were about to go testify. I was going to go testify in this hearing that, wait a minute, you know, they wrote a ping warrant to apprehend, but they didn't apprehend for about a week or so. And then they used the information from these pings to obtain more evidence, which is basically they lied on the affidavit. That's not why they wanted the affidavit. They wanted the affidavit to go get more evidence. Well, as soon as it was brought to the district attorney's, and this is my understanding, my opinion, once they brought it to the DA's attention that we were going to testify to this, they offered a deal that just couldn't be turned down because they did not want me to testify because it potentially could have gotten up to three detectives from different agencies fired or put on the Brady list, which we all know once you're put on the Brady list, you can't work in law enforcement. So the DA was covering for these investigators who wrote a bad warrant that, and I don't know how you can accidentally write a ping warrant to go arrest someone and then say, we're not going to arrest them for a week. I don't care where the pings come up until we find more evidence. I don't know how you can get around that conversation. You know, so that was a real problem for me, is to see things like that where they're still using evidence that's not obtained legally, and then they're covering for each other so they won't be held accountable for their actions.
Right. You know, and I mean, you and I have talked about this before. You know, it's not that, you know, there's a lot of very good law enforcement officials out there, a lot of police officers.
99%.
You know, I mean, heck, we know a lot of them that are still in the profession. And unfortunately, right, it's these bad apples that cause the whole profession to kind of have a tarnished reputation. You know, at the end of the day, you know, it should be about, right, gathering the information in a legal way. If you have to do things illegally or unconstitutional, then you probably should not be doing it, right? I mean, right. Let's be honest, you just shouldn't be doing it. You can find other ways of gathering that information, gathering those facts. It may result in your investigation having to be longer, right, before you can actually find somebody responsible for it. But at the end of the day, you know, that you cannot afford to jeopardize your integrity. And, you know, that's what unfortunately is happening. Is that example of that case you're talking about is like, if they knew that he had drugs, there's other ways that they could have obtained,
right,
you know, the information legally and gotten to the same result. But instead, they try to cut corners by doing it the way they did it.
Because they could have just put a GPS tracker on his car.
Right.
And they would have gotten the information.
Right. You know, it's just like this, you know, I heard you make a real short reference to the Morphy case, the Barry Morphy case. And I don't know a lot of those details in that case. But, you know, one of the most disturbing parts of that case that I found out about more recently, and I, you know, I hadn't been following it. And for those of you that don't know about the Barry Morphy case,
oops. Uh-oh. Did we lose John?
I'm sorry.
Oh, you, I don't know if it's a Zoom issue or whatever, but you froze for me. So I don't know if you froze for everybody else, but just keep going.
Okay. If you can hear me. So the Barry Morphy case, right? It's about a guy who was accused of killing his wife whose body has never been found. And Barry Morphy, it's a well-known case. It's out of the Salida Judicial District. And what happened was, you know, he's arrested. He hires his legal team. But what was interesting in that case, and I just got wind of this just more recently, was that there was DNA. Now get this. This is crazy. There was DNA that was recovered during the search of either her vehicle or
Uh-oh. The case now he's very well. Well, you froze for me again for a long time.
Oh, geez.
Thomas, can you tell me if everyone else could hear what he just said and it was just me? Do you know? Well, we don't know. But the bottom line is they found DNA in the vehicle. Said
it froze for them as well. It might be my connection, and I apologize, Mark.
Well, you know what? It may be that the local DA's office is locked on to us. But the bottom line is in her vehicle, they found DNA from an unsolved serial killer. Is that right?
Well, two different murders, one in Arizona and one in Chicago. So how do you get two different locations of the country and then you have that same DNA somewhere in college? There's no innocent explanation for that.
Right.
Right. But yet your main suspect in this case is her husband, which, you know, any logical, you know, anybody investigating a murder case, we always look at the people closest to that individual first, right? So it was natural for them to look at Mr. Morphew or anybody else that was associated with her. But the fact that you have these two great pieces of physical evidence that you just
point
ignored,
someplace else.
Yeah, from someplace else.
You arrest them anyway.
Yeah.
And I can't remember, did they hold that evidence or that discovery from the defense team for a while?
I don't know a lot of the specifics of whether it was held or not held, but I can tell you that, you know, ultimately the defense got wind of that. And, you know, I don't know if you recall, but there was a CBI agent who actually, I think, you know, had some level of integrity who says we should not have made the arrest.
Right.
We should have held off on the arrest.
Exactly. And, you know, I still teach down at Pikes Peak Community College for new recruits wanting to get into law enforcement. And I tell them, do a thorough investigation before you arrest, because you could establish probable cause, but still continue. If you have leads to follow, keep following those leads, and you might lose probable cause. Yep. And so don't just arrest someone once you achieve probable cause. Do a thorough investigation. And one of the things I found, you know, because my expertise is on cellular technology and cell phone records, I found that the lack of law enforcement doing a thorough investigation can actually handcuff, how ironic I use that term, the defendant from defending himself. It's like, no, if you'd have gotten all this evidence from social media, Facebook, from Google or whatever that you should have done, you should have been proactive in this. But because you didn't get that, if someone's accusing me of something and then they say, oh, we communicated on Snapchat, well, you better go get the stuff from Snapchat very quickly, which we know that's a problem. But let's say Facebook, and then they don't get the information. And then they go just with this individual saying that I did this. It's like, why didn't you get the Facebook? You charged me 6 months later, and now I don't have the opportunity to go get that information. Right. I've definitely found, from my standpoint, the lack of providing discovery is huge. It just seems like on so many cases, when I get involved and I ask the defense attorney, give me all the discovery about the technical stuff. And then I'll find that, well, wait a minute, you don't have this. And then they ultimately have to go back to the DA and say, come on, you know, we need all the discovery. So that's another thing that I really like where we're at in the system, if you want to say that, because we legitimize or we make law enforcement, I think we take it to a higher standard or a higher bar when we call them out and question, you know, hey, you need to be doing this, this, and this. So when we bring that out, guess what they're going to do next time? X, Y, and Z.
And I think anybody who's ever been accused of a crime, I mean, you know, that's
falsely
what
accused.
I mean, you want that, right? You want somebody who's going to hold law enforcement accountable. Unfortunately, you know, it's become more of a gamesmanship situation as opposed to what's right. It's as opposed to justice. And you know, not to say that there's not some good prosecutors out there. What I'm telling you is that we're seeing, unfortunately, too many of these types of cases, and it should not happen. It should not even happen once, because, you know, we're talking about people's lives, and all it takes is the one accusation. I mean, you know, I'm sure, you know, your listeners are probably aware of, you know, people who have been wrongfully accused of a crime. And there's nothing worse than being accused of something you didn't do, especially a crime. You know, it's one thing like when it's just, hey, you were there, and I, you know, and you say, no, I wasn't. Yeah, you were there. But it's another thing to say, hey, you were involved in X. You were involved in my case, involved in kidnapping. You know, like kidnapping. What? I never kidnapped anybody. But you know, the mere allegation is just so life changing. And you know, to kind of wrap up what you were originally, I think, trying to talk about, which is the grand jury. The grand jury process, you know, is unfortunately designed for only one side. There's really no checks and balances because you only hear it from the prosecution. You don't get a chance to hear anything from the defense. And so these prosecutors who are so hungry to try and make an arrest, they'll do, some of these guys are willing and ladies are willing to do pretty much anything to secure that indictment. And then, you know, once that indictment is secured, they go out and make the arrests. Well, guess what? Now, whoever's been arrested is the one holding the bag, and they have to prove their innocence. And that's not the way the system was designed. It was designed that you're innocent until proven guilty, not the other way around. But unfortunately, especially in today's time, right, with social media and everything, if you're alleged to have committed a crime, it's out in the media. It's out there. There is no taking it back. Right. You can't unring that bell. You cannot hit the delete key. Once somebody makes an allegation makes any kind of allegation like that, especially a criminal allegation, you're pretty much done. I mean, you can go anywhere in the world and you can do a background and you can find out, hey, this person, you know, this teacher, Mark, we've worked on cases where teachers were accused of a crime that they didn't commit. But yet,
their careers are ruined.
It's over. Yeah, I mean, think about it. A student has a crush on a teacher. You know, teachers like, I'm married or I have a girlfriend. That's not good enough, right? So they make an allegation that the teacher tried to touch them. And all it is that mere allegation of them being touched. Guess what happens? The teacher's is suspended, right? Pending the outcome of an investigation. Law enforcement gets involved in investigating this deal. And in the meantime, right, even if they don't find anything, the fact that there's an allegation against this teacher is enough to change their whole career path. They're no longer going to be a teacher.
And God forbid they can't afford to get experts.
That's right.
Because, I mean, I hate to say this, we're not cheap. Yeah. And so to bring us in, and we make good things happen, if you want to say that, and we make sure that the process was done correctly. We make sure that the facts and the evidence that law enforcement presents is legit. And, you know, and I find in many cases, especially one I'm working on right now, where they just conveniently left out some call detail records, some cell phone records, because it didn't promote their agenda on this case. And there's really no reason to do that. Just put it all out there and then let the jury decide. But unfortunately, too much, you know, like you said, it's this win attitude. We got to win it all, you know, if we charge them. And unfortunately, you know, when juries come in, when individuals come in, and I've sat on a jury, when you come in, you're like, well, they don't indict innocent people.
Right.
There had to be something.
Right. Well, because we hold cops and law enforcement to a very high standard.
We think that, you know, but unfortunately, I'd have to say that at this point, I think when people walk into a jury, they need to be skeptical of the evidence and listen to all the experts and everything that's presented. Because unfortunately, at this point, you know, they really do need to get rid of qualified immunity for district attorneys.
Immunity. It's not even qualified. It's absolute immunity.
Well, it should not be absolute immunity. I mean, that's insane.
Right.
Because you let people like Dan May and Mark Hurlburt, you let them run rampant with the system. You are giving them a huge sword that they can go through and go after political enemies or individuals that they know did not commit a crime. It's like, hey, let's jam them up. Let's indict them because we can give false information to a grand jury. See if we can get him to come in and lie to a grand jury to go after this individual. And then they openly admit, yeah, you know, I used this person to get to this person. Yep. And there's nothing you can do about it.
That's right.
I know we need to wrap this up. I can't remember. I haven't gotten the 1 minute warning, but I think it's something that we need to wrap up soon. Hopefully, you know, I know everybody loves Chuck and Julie. I love them to death. I love watching their show. I love listening to all the political stuff. John and I just aren't that political. We love talking about law enforcement, the judicial system, and all kinds of stuff. So we love coming in here every once in a while. So you guys need to, if you like kind of the stuff that we're talking about, and we can talk a lot more. We know who killed JonBenet. So one of these days we'll admit that's not true. I'm making that up. So, but there's a lot of things that we can talk about in the judicial system, about our experiences, both from being in law enforcement and then now being working predominantly. I would love to do more work for prosecutors, but they have their experts, so they don't really need us as much. But I love sitting in that chair and helping to make sure the system is fair for everybody. And that's our goal. And I think, John, you would agree.
I absolutely agree, 100%.
Yeah, our goal is to make sure that the system is working appropriately. And we're both pro-law enforcement. My daughter's a detective, and my son-in-law is a deputy up north. So we love law enforcement. We just want to make sure that the process is pure and that we rat out the individuals that we know are corrupt, and they have no business being in the judicial system. They need to go find something else to do. So I'm sure Chuck and Julie will be talking a lot more on Friday. Friday is supposed to be a wonderful day for weather. So I hope everybody's looking forward to it. And I hope that at some point, John and I can come back and do their show again sometime. Everybody have a great Wednesday. Hopefully the Avs will win tonight. And just cinch that whole thing up. I know I'll be watching the game, and I hope to see everybody soon. So we'll see you later. And thanks for watching the show.
Thanks, Mark, for having me.